Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to Mazda's focus to ensure every element of a car is designed around the driver. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. On the local news roundup, racism rears its ugly head in Charlotte as most, if not all, of this city's black leaders receive a derogatory letter evidently inspired by Donald Trump. No charges filed against the officer involved in the shooting of Donquarius Franklin. We detail the reasons and hear about reaction. Ernest Winston is sworn in as the new CMS superintendent. The mayor defends city council's closed-door meeting concerning our hosting of the Republican National Convention. And the Catholic Diocese in Charlotte plans to share the list of clergy credibly accused of sex abuse. It could include 20 names, but when? Our roundtable of reporters is ready to detail those and other stories, and those reporters include David Borax from WFAE News. Good morning.
Good morning, Mike.
Katie Peralta is here. She's a reporter for Charlotte Agenda. You've moved.
I've moved.
Well, nice to see you here.
Nice to see you, too.
Mary C. Curtis is a columnist for Roll Call and a contributor to WCCB-TV News Rising. Good morning.
Good morning, Mike.
And Jonathan Lowe is a reporter and anchor for Spectrum News. Welcome back.
Good morning, Mike.
We're all here on the radio. You can also watch us on Facebook Live. Well, for weeks, the country has been involved in discussions about racism, due in large part to recent tweets on the part of the president, indicating a racist streak in his thinking. His comments have appeared to have emboldened a lot of like-minded thinkers, and this month it filtered down to our level. It was revealed that racist, threatening letters were sent to all of the black leaders in our community, from city council to county commission to the school board to the police and fire departments and to the mayor. At a recent county commission meeting, Commissioner Vilma Leek read from the letter she received, which invoked our great president, Donald Trump.
Each of you black Democrats should be tarred and feathered and run out of town on a rail. Nothing but nothing good will come to you if you don't change. And on that note, I do believe you need to go back to where you came from if you don't begin to show this great country some respect and honor. Your freedom was born on the backs of great Americans, white Americans, who fought for you. So get over it, assimilate. If not, I'm afraid that one of these days some will recognize what you really stand for or don't stand for and will round you up and all of you and send you screaming to the concentration camps where you belong.
As I mentioned, that letter invokes, and I want to put quotations on this, were not my words, quote, our great president Donald Trump, end quote. The letter also contained the warning, leave our Confederate memorials and statues alone. If not, I am sure there are some that will be blowing up the infamous adulterer MLK statues. Do we know if all of the city's black leaders received that letter or letters similar to that letter?
Yeah, I do know. I talked to Commissioner Leek, today, Friday, so day before yesterday, Tuesday, at the superintendent swearing in. And I know that, so she received one, the school board chair, Mary McCray, received one, Charlotte City Council mayor received one, Charlotte City Council member Braxton Winston received one. So it appears that at least, I believe, 12 is the number, black leaders in Charlotte, Mecklenburg.
So this particular letter was signed, quote, a faithful, loyal, proud American first and Charlotte native born and bred second. All caps. County Commissioner Mark Gerald pointed out the anonymity of the writer.
It's clearly someone who, in the social media sphere, would be a Twitter gangster or a Facebook warrior, but obviously a coward because they couldn't even sign their name to it.
So Phil Malik has asked the FBI to investigate this. On Wednesday, the FBI told WCNC-TV that they had not yet begun investigating. Has that changed since that time?
I do believe, Mike, that has changed. I know that the FBI has now said they are aware of these letters that were sent to these 12 officials and that they have been in contact with Charlotte-Mecklenburg police. to keep an eye on if there is any sort of, as they look into this, so we know people are looking into it, if there is any sort of federal violation.
But, well, I've got to ask about that because Braxton Winston, City Councilman Braxton Winston, who is African-American, has pointed out the purpose of this letter was to intimidate. Is the intimidation of elected officials a crime?
I do believe I've heard racial intimidation. I don't know if it's a civil rights violation on the DOJ level, but Mary, you might.
Well, we have seen this is a dilemma that the FBI nationally, as we have seen them raise the threat of white identity domestic terrorism, and we've seen attacks on mosques, synagogues, and of course the massacre in El Paso, and it's difficult because they have to tread a thin line. What is the First Amendment to free speech? You know, offensive talk can be, you know, protected under the First Amendment, but how do they figure out when it's going to turn into an actual threat? And so they really want more attention, money, and so forth put toward it. After 9/11, so much emphasis was put on foreign terrorism that they did not have basically the support to fight this threat. And during the Obama administration, when they tried to raise this, there was a lot of pushback of folks saying, you're trying to dampen folks' right to free speech. But now they see that this speech can turn into consequences. As you said, Mike, you used the word embolden. These feelings have always been there, that for African Americans whose relatives and ancestors have been here for generations, citizenship is somehow conditional. But now you see folks bringing this out and saying it in a very bold way. And the FBI has been, you know, a little bit late to this, and they've admitted this.
I think Commissioner Jarrell and Commissioner Winston's point that they made earlier in the week, you know, all of these bodies, City Council, County Commission, and the school board, you know, we cover their meetings. They have public forum periods during all of their meetings. And, you know, I have not heard anybody get up on the dais during any of those public forum periods and say anything to the level
right
that has been said in those awful
Well, letters. I read the letter. There's nothing in there that threatens anybody personally or a body, a governing body in any way. It is a disgusting letter with language that is repulsive.
They did use terms saying blow you up. So
they did.
There was a piece in some of the letters where they used, we should, you know, blow up the statue and blow you up.
Yes.
Round
okay.
you up, I think, was another term.
Yes, and put you in concentration camps.
This also comes, a week after County Commission proposed about $12 million in added security measures for the government building. So, I mean, this sort of thing gives that a lot of weight.
Yep.
You know, it is, if you are feeling unsafe on a day-to-day basis in the place where you work, I mean, that this adds a lot of weight to that, and it really makes sense that they would want some, you know, added safety.
I know these public officials personally, to the extent of seeing them every week at these meetings, and I know that they won't be intimidated. You know, we're having this conversation about that part, and I know that federal officials are looking into whether there was a violation of intimidation. But I know Mary McCray. I know Mark Jarrell, Braxton Winston, the mayor. These are not people that will be easily intimidated.
Yeah. We're going to hear from Mary in a moment. David.
I was just going to say that one thing that's different right now is that the number of African Americans in positions of power in Charlotte right now is the most it's ever been. Most of the key positions in the city and county are held by African Americans. And I think that creates a different situation from years past when it might have been a lone official sitting on a board who would get a threatening letter like this. And I think now they do feel that it's okay for them to talk about it and to be defiant. And I think that's what we're seeing here.
And let's not forget, I mean, we have had folks in coded language. Remember when former Mayor Pat McCrory said on his show something about the kinds of folks who were very much involved in running city government, and it was a little different than it had been. So just to point out and back up what you said, David, the sense of the taking over, which is reflected nationally in the language of some of our leaders of a great replacement or an invasion. And there are some folks who have a problem with a majority-minority country down the road. And in Charlotte, the fact that we already have a majority-minority city,
yeah.
And even though all of these officials are very different in their approaches and their politics and their backgrounds, there will be some who will see it and feel, in a sense, threatened.
And just to point out the obvious, these folks weren't put here by anybody. They were elected.
They were elected and by its citizens.
They
yes.
don't all, there's this assumption that because they're all, you know, most of them are where we're talking about people of color. But as it relates to Charlotte, the commissioners, they're all Democrats. And then the Charlotte City Council is mostly Democrat. But so I think there's this assumption that because they're people of color and because they're Democrats, that they're automatically liberal or not as conservative. And you know, that couldn't be more untrue. These commissioners and these city council members have varying opinions and varying political views that the person that wrote this letter probably is not, well,
but we've seen
obviously
that.
Obviously, is not aware of.
We've seen that for many folks of color, they are not thought of as individuals, but as a group. I mean,
right.
It's reflected in the emails I get from folks who obviously haven't read what I've written, but they feel they look
I
at
get
my
them
picture,
too.
And
so
yeah,
this may,
they
this
know
may,
what I'm
this, may, this incident yeah. may have come as a surprise to a lot of people out there who are not people of color. District 6 Representative Susan Rodriguez McDowell did not receive one of those letters, but she spoke at the commission meeting saying, "For those of you in our community who think that racism is an overused buzzword and is not real and you don't experience it, you need to be made aware. It is very much real right here in this community, in this room today." And to underline that, the letter was not the only incident of racial communication to local officials. At a recent CMS school board meeting, Chair Mary McCray shared some emails and also the names of the senders of those emails.
I'm going to read you some snippets of a couple of emails that I've received. And Mr. Winston, I'm going to apologize beforehand for your daughters being here to hear this. This email is from a young lady named Jamie Lawrence. She said, "Your obvious racism over the last 7 years has come to a head with the hiring of Ernest Winston, a person with no superintendent experience." This next email comes from a gentleman named Tommy Smith. "So you feel you're on a great course and you want to stay the course. Sure doesn't hurt that Ernest Winston is black, does it? You on the school board don't even bother to try to hide it, do you? You folks are making CMS a sewer."
She went on to say that never before with the hiring of several superintendents while being on this board have I received communication with such racism. This is not about the capability of Ernest Winston to lead this district, but all about the fact that he is a black man. And he's not the first black man to head the school system. Jim Pusley led the school district between 2002 and 2005. Now, she said a racially offensive word in that piece of tape that we chose to bleep. It was an editorial decision that I didn't make because I would have aired it. And I want to get your opinions on this. She was reading those emails to make a point. By our not allowing her to make that point, have we gotten in the way?
Well, I think that folks can have very legitimate opinions on both sides. So this is just speaking for myself and as someone who has gotten those and have been involved in discussions in newsrooms about it. I always feel we should say it at least the first time the way it is written, because that is the news and people need to hear that as well. And for many of us who get it uncensored all the time, it's educational to hear it raw. But I can see where folks will say it is an obscenity like any other. It's traumatizing.
Actually,
and they just
not,
don't want
that
to.
That particular word was not an obscenity. It may be obscene to some, but it's not an official obscenity. We can talk more about this after the break. And Mary C. Curtis with us along Jonathan Lowe, Katie Peralta, and David Borax. It's WFAE Charlotte Talks. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to drivers that share Mazda's passion that cars make driving matter. More at MazdaOfSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. It's the local news roundup, and that is why David Borax is here from WFAE News. Jonathan Lowe, reporter anchor for Spectrum News. Katie Peralta, reporter for the Charlotte Agenda. And Mary C. Curtis, columnist for Roll Call, contributor to WCCB-TV News Rising. We were talking about these racist letters that have come to all the black leaders of our city, and also a series of emails that Mary McCray, the school board chair, shared at the recent school board meeting. She has said, "We have all received some emails that have not been very nice about some of the actions we have taken. We're all big boys and big girls, so we can take it. But it comes to a point where you have to say, enough is enough." I want to get back to editorial content just for a moment, because these are decisions that are made, and they are neither right nor wrong. People have to make decisions at upper levels, and we chose to bleep that offensive word, which is highly offensive to a lot of black people. But I think to go back to the point of City District 6 Representative Susan Rodriguez McDowell, a lot of people deny the existence of racism. They say it's not there. If you don't ever hear it, it's not there. It doesn't exist. So if we bleep it, it doesn't exist.
And you also,
if the newspaper doesn't print it, and they didn't, it doesn't exist.
Well, I don't. My check doesn't say, my paycheck does. I'm not on that level, but I will. I think it's important for people to know, as a reporter, I think it's, we put the information out there. So without knowing what the word is, I think people then miss the meaning behind the word. It starts with a C. I will not say the word, but I will read a
yes,
definition.
Yes, what does it mean? Give us the definition.
It is a derogatory term for black people similar to the N-word, originally a shortened form of the word raccoon, used in reference to the animal. The black eye masks and nocturnal habits of the animal parallel the characteristics of typical robbers and thieves. The stereotype was then applied to black people.
Okay. So why is this racism? Go ahead, David.
I just want to say, in this discussion about whether to air or broadcast or print the word in question, and the N-word, this is something in newsrooms that we struggle with. And there's one concern is that we're giving a platform to these folks who are racist and that
we don't want to do that.
And we are allowing them to get it out there. I mean, you can imagine somebody listening to this broadcast, if we had aired the actual word, that they'd be cheering that they got their message out to a wider audience.
Well, the fact that we're talking about it.
Well, it's true. They've still got their message out. On the other hand, there is the concern that it will offend people. And, even within our own newsroom, there's been a debate about this. And
but there are a lot
back to your point, Jonathan.
David, there are a lot of things in the news that I find morally reprehensible and highly offensive, like the murder, the mass murder of people week after week after week. Should we not talk about
it? I agree with you, Mike. And, but I would say that back to Jonathan's point earlier, even African Americans have a range of opinions on this. And so, whether we chose to broadcast it or not is definitely open to debate, and we are discussing it.
What is important about this, though we're not, we're making the decision, we as a industry making the decision not to air her word. Mary McCray is very smart, intelligent, former educator. She would not have used that word if she didn't intend for
exactly
people to hear it.
My point, exactly.
But I wanted to say, Mike, that to say again what David said, that there are people of all races, including African Americans, who are on both sides of this. Because for some African Americans, as I said, I would put it out there, but it is a trauma to hear it. It is hurtful. And so you have to know. I mean, I was.
But is this being politically correct?
What?
Not using the word, allowing her to say the word.
Well,
in public.
I just think that you have to acknowledge that this is a hurtful, traumatic thing. And so while some African Americans like myself would say, put it out there because it is what is real, others would say, you know what, enough trauma in my life. We know what they said. The people will know what they said. So I'm just saying that you can have a legitimate opinion on both sides.
So the larger question is, why now? Why are these letters coming out now? I have a WBTV is reporting that the school district says that a 72-year-old man from Cornelius sent the letter to Winston. There was evidently a letter that went to Ernest Winston, the new school superintendent. and Cornelius police went to the man's house to warn him not to do this again. Officers told him that if he did and it rose to the level of a criminal offense, charges could be filed. I'm not sure exactly what that letter said because I haven't seen it, but why now? What is giving rise to this stream of racist invective?
This is not new, Mike. This has been going on for a long time, but we may be seeing more right now, and it's being discussed publicly because of the climate that has been created in the country.
Yes, and we can say, you know, why are Mexican-American children who are citizens who have been in this country for years hearing from their classmates for the first time, you know, teasing about, are you a citizen, and building a wall and sending you back? Let's face it, we have some of this conversation and invective coming from some of the highest quarters. You know, we've just had in the news Congressman King of Iowa being in the news yet again for saying very offensive things, who was still elected by his constituents. And so I think, as you said earlier, it's emboldened. It's not that it hasn't been there along. I don't know of any African-American person who thought we were in a post-racial country when Barack Obama was elected president, because they know that this has been the strain of this country that we've not really dealt with. We've not had our Truth and Reconciliation Commission as South Africa has had. But now it seems that we are just making it allowable to be public about these things. We're saying send her back in rallies about citizens. And so people feel, you know, a little bit like they have a little bit of support doing this. And it really does make you look around and look at your neighbors and say, wow, is this what you've been thinking all along?
So Charlotte Mayor Vial Lyles was on this program on Wednesday. I brought this up. She had not, and she received the letter, which she had not seen. And her assistant, who was here with her, said, we haven't shown it. She just came back from vacation. We haven't shown it to you yet because you had higher priorities to deal with. She says she doesn't think this string of invective is a sign of something larger coming to the surface in Charlotte.
We received that letter, but, you know, this past week I got a letter from as the guy says, I want you to know I'm an old white guy that's been in Charlotte a long time, and I think that the city's going in the right direction. So I don't believe, you know, I'm kind of going back to my stat days in graduate school, which was many years ago, but you can't just extrapolate from one letter a trend or a decision about a group of a city of 865,000 people.
Is she right?
I think she's absolutely
yes.
right.
Yes, I do.
I think
yeah.
she's absolutely
And you couldn't live in Charlotte without having that hope that she
yes.
is right.
And I was born and raised here. I think she is absolutely right.
Okay.
Yeah.
A decision came down this week in the case of CMPD officer Wendy Curl, who shot and killed Danquirius Franklin at a Burger King on Beatty's Ford Road back in March. Mecklenburg County DA Spencer Merriweather told WFAE this week that he and a dozen prosecutors unanimously decided they could not convince a jury that the officer was not justified in the shooting.
This is a judgment over something that really, an interaction that took place over 36 seconds. And yet, as tragic as it was, it did require a lot of thought and a lot of consideration by the folks in my office, and we tried to give it that. At the end of the day, there is nothing about a judicial process or a review process by a prosecutor's office that's going to make anybody feel good today.
So Merriweather also pointed out that it appeared on the body cam footage that Franklin was complying with the officer's instructions to drop his gun, and he called the shooting tragic. He noted this was a split-second decision, but not one they could prove was unreasonable. What has been the reaction to that decision not to prosecute?
So I talked to Corinne Mack. She is the president of the Charlotte-Mecklenburg branch of the NAACP. Basically, she said that this was to be expected. She did not. She wasn't surprised that.
To be expected because this is what always happens, or because of the evidence?
She said that when it comes to, these are her words, police officers shooting and killing black people, particularly, she said, black men, that it's happened over and over and over where the officer is not charged or found to be at fault.
Spencer Merriweather decided that his office would have been unable to convince a jury that the officer was not justified in the shooting. A lot of double negatives in there. But isn't that a jury's decision to make? Is this how things go to trial? on a normal basis. They either think they can convince the jury or they can't. And if they think they can't, the case to whatever it is doesn't go?
Correct.
Okay. So, particular to this instance.
Correct. And Robert Dawkins with Safe Coalition NC says that, he wasn't surprised either because the DA came to that decision because of how the law is written.
Yeah, he wasn't surprised, but he was disheartened.
The only way for an officer to be guilty is for him to be, guilty of doing something that the average officer in his situation would not do. Is a legal precedent that makes it almost impossible to get an officer convicted unless they do something just seriously over the top, like shoot you with your back turned.
It's Robert Dawkins of Safe Coalition. CMPD is continuing their internal investigation. Why is all this taking so long?
They want to go through it carefully and weigh it against all the information that they have. It's going to take a while. I would think that CMPD probably is pretty close to having everything they need. I mean, the DA took over 3 months to do this. But I want to bring up another point, which is, and my fellow panelists, correct me if I'm wrong, but in reading that 60-something pages from the DA, there's not really an acknowledgement here that it was a white officer and a black victim. And like so many of these cases, we don't have a prosecution here. There's a larger problem here, and it's there whether it turns up in an individual case or not. And I think that's a problem.
I think Gwendolyn Glenn from WFAE did a good job in kind of pressing Meriwether on what should have been done differently, what could have been done differently, because that was a big part of what was missing, in my opinion, in the report as well. They did acknowledge that Dan Quirias Franklin was bipolar, for instance. He didn't have any alcohol or drugs in his system. He did appear to be putting the weapon down. What could have been handled differently, knowing all of this after the fact? And Meriwether couldn't answer. And, de-escalation, of course, but,
I think that wasn't really his focus. I don't think his job was not to find whether the officer was violated any policies or there was a lack of training and they should have had. That wasn't his job. His job was simply to find out whether Officer Wendy Curl acted criminally. I think that we are now this week, the police chief held a news conference. CMPD made sure to publicize certain efforts that they have going on and training that they have going on to hopefully de-escalate these type of situations. But back to Robert Dawkins, Safe Coalition sent the chief a letter back in May asking for CMPD to reevaluate its de-escalation, having an officer use any and all de-escalation techniques before using deadly force, but also requiring officers to intervene if they see a fellow officer using excessive force, which relates back to the Dan Quirias Franklin shooting, because in that video we saw there was only a matter of time of a minute and 10 seconds from the time that Officer Wendy Curl and Officer Larry Deal exited their vehicle to the time of the shooting. So a lot of activists and people who scrutinized the shooting said there was not enough done to de-escalate the situation. There was not, the other officers didn't try to intervene with Officer Wendy Curl to calm her down and slow down the situation. So, yes, there are some things that came out of this 162-page report from the DA, but I don't think that was his job. I think there was a lot of before, during, and after that they had to look
at. But there were a lot of questions in there, too. I heard that report, and he was very careful to also say that the officer was inconsistent in some of her statements with the video, whether she had actually tried to talk with him after the gun, and basically that the gentleman who was next to him, that he didn't really feel in danger, but then he said, I didn't know his mindset. And he felt that, that would give the jury reasonable doubt. But he was very careful to say there were some things there, as you say, that leave it open for the police to perhaps come in and look at just what happened.
Exactly. Sounds very Mueller-ish.
Yes.
I just want to add a couple things here. maybe we need bystander training for fellow officers who are in this situation.
That's
to
what
empower
Safe
them,
say.
Right, to empower them to step in and say, Wendy, you know, calm down or something. But I wanted to say that if anybody's interested in this discussion about what the law says, there is a lengthy section in the report where they recap the case law on this. And I was at a public forum after this shooting at one of the churches on Bates Ford Road, and the chief stood up and talked about it and had the police department's lawyer get up and talk about the case law and how there is this standard of reasonable, would a reasonable person feel in fear of their life. And in the report, he gives a lot of weight to the statements from the officers about how they felt at that moment. Now, if you had done something like this, you would make a statement saying, I felt threatened. You know, there
That's
may be
the
more
thing.
Here.
You know, it feels like an officer can always say, I was in fear for my life. And so we have to look at that.
So as I mentioned earlier in the program, the mayor was on this program earlier this week. We talked about a number of things, including the Lake Arbor Apartments. That's an affordable housing complex that is undergoing renovations to bring it up to code. I think there are 300 empty units at the moment, and they're asking everybody who's there, the tenants, to vacate, I think, by the end of the month, because they have to spruce up the apartments. And a lot of these people cannot afford to move. They can't afford the security deposits or the transfer of utilities, et cetera. But she seemed to think, the mayor seemed to think, that they would be getting some help. And Spectrum News reported this week that a Charlotte law firm is filing a class action suit and warning displaced families at Lake Arbor not to sign away their legal rights. What's this about?
Well, you know, it's all very disheartening because, you know, a lot of, as you mentioned, Mike, a lot of these people don't really make very much money and are living check to check. And so it's about 177 units that they're going to have to renovate and redo.
Why don't they renovate the first 300 empty units and then move those folks into those empty units and then renovate the
Actually, there's 288 units in the complex. Yeah. 177 are occupied. 78 of those are ordered to get out by the end of the month, the rest by the end of the year. The lawsuit was filed by legal advocates, Legal Aid here in Charlotte, a statewide organization, and this law firm in Charlotte. And they are alleging that the owners of this apartment, who are from Brooklyn, New York, have been trying to collect rents while the apartments were not meeting code, and that's illegal. And they are trying to advocate for the residents there and to urge them not to sign any documents now.
About 100 people affected by this class action.
What documents would they be signing?
So I actually spoke to the representative of the owners this week or last week, and they are offering what they're calling an incentive package for people to get out, and they want people to clean out their apartments and turn in their keys and kind of go quietly. And they describe this as, can we just part ways amicably? And in order to qualify for maybe having their back rent forgiven and getting their security deposits back immediately instead of waiting, they want them to sign a release. And we don't know exactly what this release says, but apparently would cause them to not be able to sue in the future.
Okay, when we come back, we'll talk more about, we'll get an update on the arts sales tax that's still being debated. The calendar, the school calendar is being debated too in some quarters. I'm Mike Collins. The political world has its attention on the presidential race, but local elections coming up will have a bigger impact on the day-to-day lives of Charlottesians. 7 Democrats are on the ballot for city council at large in next month's primary. So join Charlotte Talks for a live forum with the candidates Wednesday, August 28th at 7 p.m. at Spirit Square's McGlowan Theater. And send your questions for the candidates in advance to charlottetalks@wfae.org. It's the local news roundup on 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. David Borax is here from WFAE News, Mary C. Curtis from Roll Call and WCCB-TV, Jonathan Lowe from Spectrum News, and Katie Peralta from the Charlotte Agenda. I'm your humble host, Mike Collins. New CMS Superintendent Ernest Winston was sworn in this week. When the school board selected him to replace Clayton Wilcox, they offered him a 3-year contract. And they did not conduct a search for a new superintendent. They just hired him. He'd been there for, I think, 15 or 16 or 17 years. And they said they did that to ensure stability. But we come to find out that this 3-year contract that he was given has a 60-day out clause in which the board can fire him for no reason at all. I mean, they can just say, we found a new guy. And they can get him out in 60 days with no extra pay. It stops at the end of the 60 days. How unusual is that? And if they want stability, why would they do it that way? What does that say about their intention of stability?
So my colleague Ann Doss Helms has been reporting on this, and she checked to see if previous Superintendent Clayton Wilcox had this in his contract, and it wasn't there. So this is unusual, to answer your question quickly.
Is it because this is a board going out, that there's a new board coming in, and they may have different ideas coming in November?
I think they want to leave their options open on this. And while in the short term there was stability by so quickly putting a new superintendent in place, there's still long-term questions about the school district.
Because school board chair Mary McCray, when asked about this, admitted his contract does not guarantee stability. She said, not necessarily, but I think the board is going to honor that. I'm not sure since I won't be sitting here, but that is the intent. We want to have some continuity. Are they just trying to have it both ways, or are they admitting that we change superintendents a lot?
Six and 10 years.
And this is an inexpensive way to do it.
It does sound very, we don't know how this is going to go, so we're just going to kind of take a wait-and-see approach.
And also, he does have a kind of a different background than many of the superintendents that they have hired. It seems like they do want to keep their options open. I hope that he is feeling pretty confident and going ahead and not thinking about that.
If anyone expected them to really, get serious about the churn that they've had, what is Winston, the fourth superintendent? Fifth in 8 years. Thank you. This sort of flies in the face of that. At the same time, getting rid of a superintendent is super expensive. What would they have paid Winston?
$600,000,
exactly. So
a lot of money.
It's a lot of money. A national search is a lot of money, too. So I think that maybe they're
The message to Ernest Winston, who's making a lot of money, is don't buy the Maserati quite yet. Yeah, hold off on that.
Rent, don't own.
<That's right>. and forgo the $800 suits for a while. Meanwhile, some local leaders are defying state law when it comes to the school calendar, interestingly enough. State law says that schools can open no earlier than the Monday closest to August 26th. Why? We don't know. But some public schools in Iredell County have already opened. What's going on here?
Well, actually, we do know why that law is in place.
Actually,
about 15 years ago, the state legislature passed a law because of lobbying by the tourism industry, and the idea is to keep that summer as long as possible to keep those revenues coming in. Some of the school districts, including Iredell County Schools and Mooresville Schools and about maybe a dozen around the state, have found what they think is a loophole in the law that where they declare themselves as year-round schools. And my colleague Ann Helms has been reporting on this, and so they have decided to open early, some as early as August 8th this year.
Why?
Why they're doing this is a good question, but there's a lot of people who feel that August 26th is just too late.
Do they close early? I mean, will they close in May or April?
They will meet the state minimum of 181 days or whatever it is, and that will take them out in May sometime instead of June. And so the idea is to, the summer is so long.
Yeah.
And one reason that they give is that this will allow in public schools in high school for the first semester exams to be given before Christmas instead of having a break and 2 weeks off and then exams in January. That just doesn't seem to make too much sense.
Well, but the school calendar is based on the agricultural calendar from the 19th century, and also now the tourism industry has gotten themselves involved in it. Isn't it time for a study and an overhaul?
That's what these school systems are saying. We want something different. And one of the issues here is that the big school systems, I don't think they feel as if they're as flexible and can take the risk of doing this the way that the smaller schools
are. Is the legislature, who seems to like to have their fingers in all local pies, are they going to come down on these people?
So there is a bill has been filed in the House that would change the rules and allow this sort of thing to happen. It possibly could get through the House, we're hearing, but the big roadblock will be in the Senate, which stops all reforms like this. And I think that's where it will come down. And, unless the president of the Senate is going to make a change in this, we're not going to get there.
Okay.
And one other note to make here, which is that CMS this week approved its calendar for next year, and CMS schools next year will not only not start earlier, they will start a week later. Instead of that August 26th date, or I guess it would be August 24th next year, they're going to start on August 31st, and that's because of concerns about congestion around the Republican National Convention.
When is Labor Day?
Labor Day next year would be somewhere around the 1st of
September. Monday. Yeah.
Why don't we start after Labor Day?
That's what they used to do up north, but
exactly right.
I got down here, I was like, what?
Earlier this year, the idea of a quarter cent sales tax hike to support the arts and parks and greenways was floated as a possible referendum on the upcoming November ballot. Former Mecklenburg Commissioner Darrell Williams will now chair a new organization created to convince voters to support the tax. What will the, it's called the Partnership for a Better Mecklenburg Committee. What will they be doing exactly? Do we know?
I think they will be the council that's trying to convince people to vote for it. I mean, they'll be educating people on the reason for the tax, you know, the drop in private funding for arts education, you know, nonprofits in the arts community, et cetera. You know, basically trying to debunk the idea that this is, I'm not quite sure I'm as well versed on the opponents. You know, they say it's like a tax that is levied unfairly on low-income people. I think that's one of their arguments.
It's a regressive tax.
Exactly.
Three consultants have been hired by the proponents to advise on this effort. I'm not sure why you need three consultants. On the other side is former Republican County Commissioner Matthew Ridenhour. Has anybody joined him in opposition? Do we know? Okay.
Haven't heard any major opposition to this other than that, right?
Okay, so the word on the ballot, the wording on the ballot, if it comes to that, will simply mention that we are going to vote yes or no on raising the sales tax by a quarter cent. Period. Full stop. No mention will be made of how the money will be spent. And in fact, it comes that we've come to find out a couple of weeks ago, the county commission will be under no obligation whatsoever to spend the money on the arts. And certainly future county commissions can do anything they want with that money. That is cause in a lot of quarters for concern. Even some of the arts are concerned about that, about how vague things are and about, with regard to how the money can be spent. The Mint Museum would like to use the funds so that they could have free admission to the museum. But no one knows if that can happen. Why? Is that too deep into the weeds at this point?
I think it's too deep in the weeds, and it sounds very risky, Mike, because this is exactly why it failed in Denver. Denver did this exact, tried to do the same sales tax increase or hike to fund arts. The measure went on the ballot. It really wasn't clear, and people didn't support it. And this is ultimately going to be up to the voters, and so it's baffling that you wouldn't make this. If you're trying to make this sale to taxpayers,
it's clear as possible. The other thing about this is, it was my impression, maybe I just read it wrong, that the proponents of this are alleging that the arts are in crisis because the funding model that we have relied on
post-recession
has collapsed and is not coming back. And that was where people, it was like the United Way. You would give it work to the Arts and Science Council.
And people don't do that anymore.
They don't do that anymore. And the Arts and Science Council will then disseminate the money. Well, now, the Arts and Science Council is saying the money would increase arts education programs in low-income communities. Now, nothing wrong with that, but we have struggling arts organizations that put on performances that are getting very little funding and are struggling to make it as well. So are they going to be ignored when this arts tax goes through, or is it all going to be for the children?
That's one of the bullet points that they're using to promote this.
Always.
The Arts and Science Council has seen its funding decline in recent years, and this is partly about that and about a crisis around whether the Arts and Science Council is the right way for us to fund the arts here. And I think this proposal comes from the point of, number one, trying to save the Arts and Science Council, and number two, to prop up the arts organizations.
Well, there are those who don't want to save the Arts and Science Council for many reasons, among them County Manager Dina DiIorio, who may recommend a new organization to replace or modify the ASC. So you've got that going on. You've got about, will the money go to the arts? You've got, when it goes to the arts, how will it be spent? That's a lot of things to answer between now and November.
Exactly.
Can it be done?
That's the sort of thing that's going to determine whether people vote for this or not, and I think that is, if you're a voter and you're thinking about whether to do this, that's what you need to be looking into. This won't just go to the arts. There is money thrown in
arts
there. And remember, this is a county initiative. This is not the Arts and Science Council doing this, although they hope to be a major beneficiary. But it will go to parks and recreation and other things. But the biggest share of it would go to the arts.
And that's been lost on this. I mean, the recreation, I remember when I first did this story, recreation centers such as Mallet Creek Rec Center, I mean, they are bursting at the seams. They need renovations, but their camps over the summer are always sold out. So clearly there's a demand for rec centers, but you're not hearing about that. And I just think,
because the arts is eclipsing it all, and the reason they're included in this is because the arts don't need all the money that this quarter cent sales tax would bring in, and they've admitted that.
They weren't going to get the majority of it in the beginning.
Right.
So, you know, it's just become very confusing. The waters have been muddied on this, and I just, you know, in November, it's questionable if voters
will support it.
I need to move on, but I just want to know why this money can't be earmarked, why we can't promise people, if you say yes to this, it will, in fact, go to the arts, greenways, and parks. We do that with tourist dollars. Why can't we do it
They were supposed to, Mike, that when they first did the presentation on this, I was there. It was supposed to be specific. It was supposed to be something like 25, 30 million to arts and rec centers, and the rest the county was going to decide and earmark. That's how they described it. It's gotten so off track.
Quick answer, what we're doing here has gotten way ahead of the how we're going to do it,
okay,
and that
exactly.
is probably a problem.
Okay. Earlier this year, the Catholic Diocese of Charlotte announced it would release a list of clergy members credibly accused of sexual assault. That has yet to happen. But this week, they shared more about the list. What did they reveal?
So the diocese's new second-in-command, Patrick Winslow, said that list will be coming at some TBD time before the end of the
What's
year.
What's taking so long? Other dioceses around the country have released these names. What is taking so long?
Well, that's the question here. There's now an outside firm reviewing, I think, more than 1,000 personnel files in the Catholic Diocese of Charlotte dating back to
1972. Yeah.
So we've got, and they've said that most of the people in question, if not all, are long retired or maybe dead. That doesn't matter. I mean, other dioceses, like you said, are still releasing lists.
And this week, they've removed the statute of limitations on sexual assault for the next year.
Correct.
As of 2 days ago.
And they've promised that by the end
of
the year.
So that's put some urgency on this, right?
It does. And they prompt them by the end of the year. In the diocese in Charlotte, there's a lot of mistrust because these names have been promised earlier. And as you noted, other people have pointed them out. They have said in the past they do not want to cause the folks who were abused pain. And they're saying, no, we would really prefer the transparency.
When WFAE Sarah D'Elia spoke with Father Patrick Winslow, the Vicar General and Chancellor of the Diocese of Charlotte, he said that when an allegation comes to the diocese's attention, they first notify civil authorities. Do those authorities have this list of names yet?
I don't know about that.
And if not, why not? Why is the church even involved in investigating crimes within the church? Why isn't this a civil matter?
The idea from other dioceses around the country that we know of is that these dioceses know who these priests are. They know which ones have been subject to allegations. In the Charlotte diocese, they say that this list actually is 20 names. We know that. And they are priests who were here or have moved, some of whom have moved away. Some of these alleged incidents have happened elsewhere, and the priests have come here.
Why isn't law enforcement commandeering that list or combing through the files themselves? Why is the church investigating itself? Why is the fox in the hen house?
Excellent question.
Well, you've seen in some jurisdictions, like in Pennsylvania and others, where they've been aggressive, district attorneys have come in and demanded some of these files. So I think they're hoping that if they can get ahead of it, he is promising Winslow more transparency, but we've heard that before.
So the legislature has two gun bills that are awaiting action. Governor Roy Cooper expressed disappointment this week that lawmakers shelved those bills, including the so-called red flag legislation that would allow police and family members to request a court to remove firearms from the possession of those who may be a threat to themselves or others.
A rational, common sense response, wouldn't you say? Rational changes that can keep us safe while respecting the Second Amendment, right? Wrong, say some legislative leaders in Raleigh. Guns don't kill, people do. So we endure yet another mass shooting with high-powered weapons, and again, nothing is done. Nothing. Well, it's time to do something.
And with that, he signed an executive order to have the state's top law enforcement agency train local law enforcement on threat assessment and to improve the quality of information the state provides for background checks for firearm purchases. Exactly what will happen as a result of this executive order? I've stumped the panel. Okay.
I'm thinking about blue-green algae.
Are you? Well, we're not going
to
get to that.
Dang, Mike.
It's not algae.
It's not. It's a bacteria.
It's a bacteria.
It's a bacterium, to be exact. All right. Well, that was
background training for a state and local.
That we have to stop. You must do your homework. David Borax from WFA News, Katie Peralta from the Charlotte Agenda, Jonathan Lowe from Spectrum News, and Mary C. Curtis from Roll Call and WCCB-TV. Thank you all. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, dedicated to those who believe a car should stir one's emotions and deliver a heightened state of driving. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.